You've got credit questions? I've got answers. I'm Jerry Detweiler, and this is Talk Credit Radio. We're live every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time and always on the web 24-7 at talkcreditradio.com.
Is there any place I can get my credit scores for free? I have my free credit reports, but they don't give me my scores.
I've worked really hard to make sure my credit is strong, but now I'm married and my husband's credit scores are a lot worse than mine. I don't want my husband's credit to mess up my credit.
I'm looking for a better rewards credit card. There's like a ton of rewards cards out there, and I have no idea how to choose a good one. Where do I start?
The listener lines are now open toll-free at 888-761-1490 or 941-761-1490. Welcome to Talk Credit Radio. Welcome to the inaugural episode of Talk Credit Radio. I'm glad you joined me. Stick with me today. You're going to hear from Liz Weston. She's the Internet's most widely read financial expert. We're also going to talk financial survival strategies and why college debt may not be such a bad thing. You're also going to hear from Credit.com's Beverly Herzog about why you should never give out personal information, including just a zip code, when you make a credit card purchase. And in our weekly mortgage report, you'll find out how to refinance your home, even if you're underwater. It's not a scam. But first, I'd like to thank the sponsors who make this program possible. Talk Credit Radio is brought to you by Credit.com. You can get your free credit report card at Credit.com. You'll see your credit grade, an estimated score range, plus advice tailored just for you. It's really free. You won't even be asked for your credit card number, and there's no impact to your credit score. So get your free credit report card today at Credit.com. And by YouCanRefi.com. Have you seen your home value drop to a point where you owe more on your mortgage than your home is worth? It's been rough nationwide, but there is good news. It's possible that you can refi. You may qualify for the Home Affordable Refinance Program. Find out for free. Contact the mortgage professionals at 888-777-9682 or visit them on the web at YouCanRefi.com. My first guest today is Liz Weston. She is, as I said, the most widely read personal finance columnist on the Internet. Am I a little jealous? No, not too much. And she's the author of four books, including the best-selling Your Credit Score and her newest, The 10 Commandments of Money. You may have also seen her articles in newspapers across the country, in AARP, the magazine, or for our men and women in the military, in Stars and Stripes. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks, Jerry. It's great to be here.
Well, Liz, I'm broadcasting from Florida, and you're in California. We've had rough times in both economies, so I want to talk about financial survival strategies. And one of the things you say in your book, The 10 Commandments of Money, is that you need a survival plan that includes both cash and credit cards. But aren't credit cards a bad thing when you're in trouble?
Well, they can be, and that's the problem. Is people, a credit card is a tool like any other. You can use it to build a house or you can use it to chop off your hand. So you have to be very careful about using credit cards. And what I'm telling people is the best way to use a credit card is to charge no more than 10 to 30% of the credit limit and pay it off in full every month. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is that obviously you don't pay any interest if you're paying it off in full. And the other is that unused line of credit could help you in a future emergency, because sometimes so many things go wrong at once that you can wipe out any emergency fund that you've built up, and you may need to rely on that credit. So you don't want to go out and, close all your credit accounts if you can handle, the fact that you need to be paying it off in full every month.
Well, what about the fact that a lot of lenders are closing people's credit lines or lowering their credit limits? I mean, that, in some sense, that's out of the consumer's control.
Yeah, it's absolutely out of your control, and it's actually been happening since late 2007. Some people think this is linked to the CARD Act that put restrictions on credit card companies' ability to raise rates. In fact, it had been happening for years before that came about. So what the card companies are doing is simply trying to reduce their risk. So I would say if that's happening to you, look for another credit card issuer. Go to your local credit union. See if you can open a credit card with them, because you do want to have open and available lines of credit. And having a credit account, lowered or shut down can hurt your credit score. So you want to make sure you have access to credit and have enough credit that you can be helping your score.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about budgeting. I know it's that, you know, word that no one really wants to talk about, especially when things are rough. It's really not something that most of us want to deal with. And you talk about this in the Ten Commandments of Money, your newest book. What are some of your suggestions for creating a budget that really works? And I say really works because these are tough times for many people.
They are really tough times, and for years I've been struggling with what to tell people when it comes to budgeting, because people's situations can be so different. Somebody fresh out of college is going to have a completely different financial situation from somebody who has kids and a mortgage and, you know, one spouse has just been laid off. So it's so variable. And I was really happy to find Elizabeth Warren's budget. She's the person who's the Harvard bankruptcy expert. She's helping President Obama put together the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau right now. But several years ago, she came up with this 50-30-20 budget. And just broken down, it basically says you take your after-tax income, you cut that in half, that's 50%, and that's the most you should be spending on essentially what's your overhead, the must-have expenses that you can't put off, like, you know, rent or mortgage, utilities, food, transportation costs, child care, minimum loan payments, insurance, those kinds of things that, you know, you really need to cover each month. If you can keep those expenses to 50% of your after-tax income, then you have enough room to spend 30% on your wants, which is the fun stuff, eating out, vacations, clothes, things like that. And then 20% of your after-tax income can go towards saving for the future and paying down debt.
Okay, so that sounds good. It sounds very realistic, and it just doesn't always work sometimes. I mean, some people's expenses right now are more than 50% of their income, especially if their income has gone down. What's your view on, you know, some of the more radical strategies that you may have to take if your budget is above that level?
Well, I think most people who do this the first time are going to find it is, you know, because if you're having trouble making ends meet, and you've already cut out the lattes, and you've already stopped buying new clothes, and you stopped going out to eat, you're taking care of the easy stuff. The next thing you can focus on is your food costs, because those are incredibly variable. There's tons of websites out there to help you reduce your food costs, learn how to use coupons and all that. But there's only so far you can cut that, and so you have to look at some of your other expenses, and these tend to be really hard to get down. I mean, you can, you know, do things like cancel the cable service and things like that, but typically, a lot of people are overspending on either their home or their cars, their transportation. And if that's the case, it's really hard to get out of that situation. It's expensive to move. If you're underwater on a house, it's hard to get out from under that. If you have overspent on a car, typically the best thing to do is simply drive out of the loan. In other words, keep the car, you know, until you've paid it off. But if you should happen to have some equity in the car, you owe less on it than it's worth, you might want to sell it, buy something cheaper. And then with the housing thing, you really have to get realistic about whether you can afford the house you're living in. I think a lot of people really can't. They're not getting any cooperation from their lenders as far as a modification that they can afford. So maybe they need to look at a short sale or even a foreclosure so that they can get started on rebuilding their finances rather than struggling to hold on to a house they can't afford.
Yeah, are you optimistic, Liz, that that's going to change in terms of getting the lenders on board to work with borrowers or homeowners?
Everything that's come up recently, you know, has seemed to be a solution and it hasn't worked. So I'm getting more and more cynical about whether we can really get the banks on board. What I heard from one industry representative, you know, because I was saying, hey, a lot of times a modification makes more sense than a foreclosure. You know, the bank would actually, or the lender would actually get more money if they could modify these loans. And he said, it doesn't matter. You know, the banks want it over with. The lenders want to have a quick solution. And modifications and short sales are not quick solutions. So that's why we're not seeing the level of cooperation that, you know, would seem to make logical sense. So, you know, I would try to keep my hopes alive by thinking that something will come up, but frankly, I mean, so many people have already gone under, and I'm just not sure that any of these new programs will help.
Yeah, me too. Well, Liz, the other thing you talk about in the Ten Commandments of Money is, you know, getting on the same page with your partner or spouse when it comes to money, and one of your pieces of advice is to treat your marriage like a business. What do you mean by that?
Well, it sounds very unromantic, but actually what I'm talking about is just doing the things that a healthy business needs to do to make sure that everybody's on the same page. And one of those things is to specialize. Usually with a couple, one of you is better at the day-to-day details of managing money and paying bills and all that. So let that person do that job. Let them be the chief financial officer. But it's also important in a business and a marriage to keep everybody in the loop. So you need to have regular meetings so the person who is not the CFO is kept up to date on what's going on. The other thing is successful businesses tend to have a business plan. And that's something that takes a while to work out in a marriage of, you know, how much are we going to spend? Are we going to spend it on? How much are we going to save? Where are we going to put that money? But those are conversations you need to have and get together on a plan so that you're rowing in the same direction.
Yeah, and I would imagine, you know, there's a lot of situations, certainly true of me and my husband, where we have different approaches to money and different views about it. So, you know, what if you're completely polar opposites?
Well, then you have to do a lot more talking. You know, I came into a marriage that was similar, very, very opposite, that, you know, my husband was more of a spender, not really a saver, fortunately didn't have much debt, and I was very frugal. And actually, one of the things that can really help is if you're the one who's good about money, get away from the idea that you're always right, you know, because I had this idea, I'm the money expert, he should listen to what I say. Well, the reality is, your partner has a different background, different perspectives, different things to bring to the marriage. And a lot of times those things are positive. So at the very least, you want to understand where they come from, why they make the decisions they do, to give you some understanding and compassion so you can have reasonable conversations that don't get, you know, heated and emotional. If you have compassion for each other, you're going to be able to talk better about these issues. And the other is to understand that, you know, they're bringing something to this relationship. There's something about them that you really treasured. And one of the things my husband brought to us is, you know, he made me realize it's important to live life today because I was all focused on the future and saving for the future. And we worked out a compromise where, you know, we're spending more than I might if I were on my own, but we're also saving for the future. And he's seen how saving and budgeting actually gives you more freedom. So he's on board with that. And I've seen that it's actually nice to have living room furniture rather than an empty hallway. So, you know, we're helping each other out that way.
It sounds so familiar. I thought my husband was so fun when I met him. And then later, when we started going the opposite way, it was like, this isn't fun anymore. But you do have to get back to that point where you appreciate what, you know, what brought you to that relationship in the first place, I think.
Oh, exactly. And you don't want to go into the parent-child thing, which can so easily happen with those of us who are good with money. We take this, you know, I know what's best, do it my way. And that's not a way to have an equal and equitable relationship. You really do have to listen and compromise.
Yeah. And, Liz, you're a parent now. Your daughter is about 5 now. Is that right?
She's 8, actually.
8. Wow.
Yes.
Wow. So what are you doing in terms of teaching her about money? What's the right age to get started? What kinds of things are you trying?
Well, we actually experimented. We started her with an allowance when she was 3.5 because one of the experts I read said, you know what, as soon as they understand that money buys things, you should start giving them money. And now I think that was probably a little early. And also, I've been reading some interesting research that shows that allowances don't really work. They're not teaching what we expect them to teach. You know, they kind of turn into an entitlement program pretty early. So, you know, we're tweaking things. But what we do now is we give her an allowance every week. It's not, you know, she's not paid for chores per se, but she has to get her chores done before she gets her allowance. And then she's expected to spend it not just on, you know, video games and fun things, but also some of the expenses that, you know, she wants to take on. Like if we go to the farmer's market, and she wants to buy something there, you know, she needs to be coughing it up. So, I hope it's teaching her what we think. And the other portion of it is that part of her allowance every month needs to go to savings. That's required. And if she wants to save more than the required amount, we will match it dollar for dollar. So that, hoping, is pushing across the idea that, you know, savings is a good thing, a good habit to get into.
I like that idea. Now, is she taking advantage of it? Does she value that?
She, you know, it's been sporadic, but usually it's right before we take her money down to the credit union to put it in her savings account. I'll say, okay, now, you know, you just put in the minimum amount that's required. You want to put in any extra, and normally she'll kick in a few bucks. So, you know, it seems to be working.
Yeah, now, when my daughter was about that age, Liz, I discovered that she was terrified of the bank. She did not like the idea of her money going into this place that she said could be robbed. Is your daughter giving you any resistance to taking the money out of where she can see it and touch it?
No, actually, I think we were old enough when we started the allowance itself that that hasn't come up. But I that's reminding me of a story that my in-laws tell about my sister-in-law. When she was about six, they opened her, you know, an account, and they took her down to the bank to put the money in. And the teller was explaining to her how her money would be used to give loans to businesses and individuals in, you know, what's now the Silicon Valley. And she was just shocked, like, you know, expected her money sitting there in the bank, and how dare you didn't go to somebody else.
Right, right, a loan for someone else. Yeah, that would be
like,
scary for our kids.
There? But, you know, a lot of adults have that same reaction. They don't understand that their money isn't just sitting in the bank somewhere, that, you know, it's actually out, you know, creating jobs and creating more wealth, hopefully. So, you know, it's interesting, but just having the account there has started some conversations about why it's important to save and, you know, what happens to the money. So even if they're worried about things like bank robberies, then you can talk to them about FDIC insurance and why
right.
that's important.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find that her friends, well, we're going to take a break in just a moment, so we may have to come to this after the break, but do you find, I want to talk to you when we come back about whether you find whether her friends have similar attitudes toward money or if they've done something a little bit different. And the other thing I want to make sure we talk about, Liz, is you wrote a pretty controversial article, For God's Sake, Go to College, and you're talking about some of the myths about college debt. And as someone who has talked about the dangers of college debt before, you know, I'm concerned about students taking on too much debt, but you raised some good arguments why that isn't always a bad thing. So I want to make sure that we cover that, too. And after the break, we are going to come back to Liz Weston, and today we're also going to have Beverly Harzog join us from Credit.com. And Beverly is going to explain to us why you should never give out your personal information when you make a credit card purchase, even if they ask you for something as little as your zip code. You should not give that out, and she's going to explain why. She's also our credit card diva, and she's going to tell us about the best rewards card. So please be sure to stay with us. You're listening to Talk Credit Radio. I'm Jerry Detweiler. We're here every week, Fridays from 2 to 3 Eastern Time, live on the web, or you can visit us 24/7 at talkcreditradio.com, and I love to answer your questions, so make sure you share your credit questions with me. Welcome back to Talk Credit Radio, brought to you by Credit.com and YouCanRefi.com. I'm your host, Jerry Detweiler. We're here live every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern at WWPR 1490 or on the web at TalkCreditRadio.com, where you can listen to our podcast 24/7. I'm talking with Liz Weston. She's the author of The 10 Commandments of Money, and we've been talking about financial survival strategies, kids' allowances, and all kinds of personal finance topics. Liz, before we talk about college debt, I do want to follow up with our conversation. We were talking about kids and allowances and how you handle it with your 8-year-old daughter, and I was curious if you've had any impressions about how her friends might be looking at money at their age and whether it's different.
Well, I had the opportunity to give a presentation to her brownie troop, which was really interesting because I provided some information to parents about, you know, savings and allowances and all that. And the most common reaction was, you know, we can't figure out what to do. So it seems like people are trying different things. They might not be the most consistent. I think a lot of families are hooked into the idea that allowances or money should be linked to chores. And that's absolutely fine. That's not how we do it, as I said, but that's definitely a way to do it. And then a lot of families, it may be a cultural thing where the kids are supposed to turn to the parents for money, and they don't want them to have their own necessarily to make their own decisions with. And, you know, there's really no good single direction. It kind of depends on what works for the family and what works for the child, because children are different. I would say, though, that, you know, by the time that they're 18 and off to college, they'll be managing big chunks of money all on their own. So I want my daughter, at least, to have some experience in learning that, you know, not all the money she gets is for fun, that some of the money has to go for expenses, because she's going to get that lesson when she gets her first paycheck and, you know, some of it has gone to taxes, And then when she's out on her own, and, you know, most of her paycheck will be spoken for before she even gets it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will give a plug for one of my favorite tools, and I think you like it too, Liz, the Sammy Rabbit CDs at itsahabit.com.
Oh, yes. So,
yeah, they're fun music CDs that have songs that teach kids about money. There's coloring books or books that go with them. And I know my daughter loved it and her friends loved it. We listened to the CD a lot in the car. Did you, Liz?
Yeah, I put that on for my daughter and we're both bopping away. And actually, he's got another one that just came out and they're great. They're just terrific tools. And the books are great. I used one of the books in that brownie presentation I was talking about.
Well, let's talk about college debt for a little bit. I guess that comes next after the allowances, right?
So you wrote a
column, For God's Sake, Go to College, and you were talking about some of the myths we have about college, and I think this is a really important message to counter some of the things we have been talking about, which I've talked about for years, which is the danger of running up a lot of debt as a college student. So tell me a little bit about what you found out in that column.
Yeah, one of the things that we talk a lot about is students that overdose on college loans because they've gotten so easy to get. And really the distinction we need to be making is between federal student loans, you know, which are fixed rate, tax deductible, have a lot of consumer protections, and limited. I mean, you can borrow at most $31,000 for an undergraduate education. So it's really tough to overdose at those levels. That's in contrast to private student loans, which are variable rate, which don't have the same consumer protections, but which, like federal student loans, you can't erase in bankruptcy, you know, without, you know, you're permanently disabled. Maybe you can get rid of them then, but typically you cannot get rid of student loans in bankruptcy. So people need to understand that using private student loans to pay for college is like using credit cards, except you'll never get rid of that, you know, so it's something to keep in mind. Now, with all that as background, we also need to consider the fact that there's a big population out there that is not going to college. And it surprises a lot of people to learn that only 30% of high school graduates go on to get a four-year degree. If you count degrees, that rises to 40%. But still, we're talking about a majority of people not getting a degree. And since I grew up in a rural area where most people did not go out of college, I got some insight into this, and one of the reasons that they don't go is because they're afraid of debt. You know, they're looking at people graduating from college and not getting jobs. They're hearing stories about nightmarish debt that people can't get rid of. They're not convinced that a college education pays off, when in fact it does. There's no question about that. And in fact, the premium for a degree has actually been rising. If you look at the difference now in terms of how much more a college graduate makes, it's about 60% over a high school graduate compared to less than 30% in the 70s. And the reason is not because college-educated people are earning so much more, although, you know, that's in some cases it's true, but the fact is that people with only a high school education are earning less and less. Mm. They are really behind the eight ball right now. Mm. If you look at a male with only a high school education, he's earning 30% less in inflation-adjusted terms than his counterpart 20 years ago.
Wow.
And this is just going to get worse. So we really need to get the message out. You got to go to college. Even if it's just a two-year degree, you got to get that degree.
Well, you mentioned, Liz, that the federal student loans can get you about $30,000 worth of education. What's that going to get you? Will that get you through college or?
It's going to be a stretch. If you go to a two-year school to start, those are only about, you know, typically for tuition and fees, less than $3,000. So if you stay at home, go to the two-year college, and then transfer, you know, you can get it done with the $31,000 if you're transferring to a public school, typically. But most of the time, you're going to need to, you know, work during the summers to help come up with some money. Your parents may need to kick in or borrow some money, but again, parents typically are at the worst point in their life to borrow more money. They should be saving, you know, for retirement. And I hear from way too many parents that are thinking about massive student loans or parent loans to get their kids to a school, and really most families cannot afford that.
How do you feel about parent loans, Liz, on the spectrum of different types of student aid?
Well, the advantage of them is they are federal student loans. So you still have the fixed rates. They're slightly higher, 7.9%, I think, compared to 6.8% for a Stafford loan, unsubsidized. So that, but you do have the fixed rate. You do have the consumer protections, which means, you know, you have all these different repayment plans. You can get a deferment or forbearance. So that's all true. The problem is that you essentially can borrow up to the cost of the education. So again, you can overdose on those PLUS loans very, very easily. It's very easy to talk yourself or talk, have your kid talk you into a really expensive education that you can't afford and then try to pay for it with these loans. And then here the parent is stuck with massive amount of debt at a time when they should be really focused on saving for retirement.
Yeah, I recall talking to a parent not too long ago who had about $60,000 in parent loans and two more years for two children yet to go. So those loans can be, you know, tremendously burdensome. So what are the ideas do you have for someone who is, you know, listening to this and thinking, I really want my kids to go to college. I don't have much money saved. What do you tell them to do?
Well, start talking about the economics of college, you know, by the time the kid's in high school. You don't want to be talking about this when they've got the acceptance letter in their hand to their dream school that's going to bankrupt you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You need to start talking earlier about the fact that, you know, the family's only got so much saved, that they can only afford so much. You want to go on to finaid.org, F-I-N-A-I-D, short for financialaid.org, and look at the family estimated contribution calculator that they've got there. So you have some idea what you're going to be expected to pay. A lot of families are surprised. The number is higher than they thought, you know, because they haven't saved much money. But if you have a higher income, you're going to be expected to contribute more, even if you haven't saved in a way that, you know, you might have been expected to with your income. So go figure out what you're going to be expected to contribute. And then start talking about alternatives. I mean, it's not necessarily true that you won't be able to go or your kid won't be able to go to a private school if the private school comes up with enough merit aid and other, you know, scholarships, things like that to make it affordable. But you should have some backup plans. You should be looking at, you know, public schools, state schools, some way where you can get the best deal.
And sounds like we might have lost Liz. Liz, did we lose you there?
I'm still here.
Okay, good. And so for parents whose kids are younger and they're thinking, I want to save for college, is there a safe way to save? Do you have some recommendations?
Well, I'm really a big fan of the 529 college savings plans and using the age-weighted function, which starts out a little more risky and then gets safer over time. But what I would do is by the time your kid is a freshman in high school, I'd start moving money into cash. I still think they're a little too risky at the back end, you know, when they're supposed to get more conservative, you know, because you're going to need that money. So
yeah,
I would opt to put it into cash. I don't think I'd leave it in cash when the kids are young, though, because you're just not getting the kind of returns you're going to need.
Well, and that's another thing that you talk about, Liz, in your books and your columns. You're talking about risk and when it comes to investments. And I imagine investors are sort of starting to feel a little more confident now, although we have seen, you know, quite a few dips lately. But I'd imagine investors generally are starting to feel more confident. What's your concern about risk?
Well, I think some people, after what we've been through and after watching, you know, the stock markets lose 50% or more of their value and the flash crash, I think some have been scared off. And those are the folks I want to talk to the most, because the reality is, you know, you probably can't reach your retirement goals without taking at least some risk. And if you look at the big picture, you'll find that over every 30-year period, starting back in 1928, right before the Depression, over every 30-year period, stocks returned at least 8% on an average annual basis. Some years you're way up, some years you're way down. But even if you invested right before the Great Depression and your stocks fell by 90%, as they did during that time, if you stuck it out, you'd get those kind of returns eventually. So I think two things need to be understood. Is one is that we need stock market returns to, you know, overcome inflation, because that will come back at some point. And the other thing is that you don't want to, you know, overdose on stocks. You want to have bonds and cash as well to give you some cushioning and some comfort level, because very few of us have the stamina to go through what we just went through, you know, and not freak out and not sell at the worst possible time. So I want people to understand that, you know, taking some risk is important, but you want to limit how much risk you take.
Well, Liz, I really appreciate your time today. And I know listeners can find you all over the web. They just have to Google your name. You'll come up a million times. Your books are in bookstores and on Amazon. But if anyone would like to reach you, what's the best website for them to go to?
Come to my website, which is AskLizWeston.com. And there's a contact Liz form, and you can send me an email.
You answer a lot of questions, too.
I do. Also on my Facebook page. There's a Facebook fan page for me, and that's a great way to connect with people.
Oh, terrific. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Jerry.